Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is November the 8th, 2013. Just got off an airplane at John F. Kennedy International Airport, the place, ironically, where I began my career working for the INS. Wow, 42 years ago. Unbelievable. Just returned from a five-day whirlwind tour, and I do mean whirlwind tour, of Minnesota. The force, and again, I do mean force, behind that trip was an amazing state representative by the name of Cindy Pugh. What an incredible woman. I met her through the Tea Party, and you guys know I'm not a Tea Partier. I'm a lifelong registered Democrat, but she arranged for me to speak at a whole bunch of events, arranged to have me do a couple of ride-alongs, tour a couple of prisons, meet with Republican leadership in Minnesota, went to a Republican luncheon. I just felt like I was on a merry-go-round. And not only was I going around and around and around, but I felt like one of those horses that also go up and down as it's going around and around and around. And I'm convinced that Cindy was providing the power for this ride that I was on. Unbelievable place to be. She's doing an incredible job representing her constituents. Boy, could you imagine that, representing your constituents as an elected representative? Holy smoke, imagine if that idea caught on. And before I get into what I've been doing and who I am, I just feel so fired up having just gotten off that airplane, even though I was half asleep because I did radio shows beginning at 6 o'clock this morning, believe it, and that's been a crazy day. But I also want to thank the person she describes as her partner in crime, Mara Suvanasov. I'm probably mispronouncing your name, Mara, if you're listening. I apologize, but my tongue is stuck in my face here somewhere. And, of course, Deborah Anderson, who also works as a cohort to Cindy Pugh. These three young ladies, plus all those members of the Tea Party and members of the Republican Party that I had the privilege of meeting with this past week, absolutely unbelievable. But to get back to the purpose of my program, those of you who are familiar with me know that I am, in fact, a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Did that job for 30 years. Been involved with the legislative side of the issue as well. And ever since 9/11, I have felt compelled to provide the insight, the information, the news of the day, if you will, that for the most part you will not find in the mainstream media. Lots of reasons for it. We could go on for hours just about that, just about that. But we won't. I will spare you. But I want to make note of two websites that I truly would love for you to visit. My own personal website, michaelcutler.net. If you're listening to this program, odds are probably quite good that that's how you came to the program. Michael Cutler, one word, CUTLER.net. Also, I'm a senior fellow with an organization out in California. Great people. Happy to be working with them for a number of years. Californians for Population Stabilization. Their website, capsweb.org. I am the guy that provides the insight for them on this immigration issue, which really, as I always like to point out, is not a single issue, but a singular issue, because it hammers just about every challenge and threat that America and Americans are facing today, and it's only getting worse. Absolutely astonishing. But the folks at the CAPS are great people. They're located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, great friends out there. And, you know, I always like to make the point that as winter approaches, that's certainly a great place to be. And yes, you might hear a little bit of a tinge of envy in my voice, especially as the New York air temperatures do their traditional plunge. They have some fabulous weather, just good place, good people. I'm happy to work with them. But let's get back to this other trip to a part of the country that actually is starting to chill down. They were even kind enough to arrange, I guess, some snow for me a couple of days ago. Interestingly, as I was leaving Kennedy Airport, there was a partial eclipse underway. I guess it was the stars really did line up for this trip. And so, Cindy, if you're listening, I thank you so much for being such an effective representative of your people, for being so hospitable, to providing me the kind of a tour of your area that really most people could only dream about. Absolutely incredible. And the folks that I met are really amazing. And I want to make a point, by the way, before we go further, because I think this is really super important. I'm a Democrat. Most of the people I know here in New York City are Democrats. And unfortunately, the Tea Party gets a pretty bad rap, and it bothers me. It bothers me because I am such a great believer in the First Amendment. You know, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, everybody rattles it off. There's two other components to that very important First Amendment. And in point of fact, that's why it is the First Amendment. It also includes the right to seek redress of grievances. And boy, if you don't have grievances, check for a pulse. And it also talks about the right of peaceable assemblage. Think about it. Why in the world did the Founding Fathers want us to engage in peaceable assemblage? Because they understood that the democratic process cannot exist, let me reemphasize that, if you don't have debate, discourse, discussion, and maybe on occasion a good argument. Not everybody is going to see eye to eye. And what really twists my tail, as it were, is that we hear all this business, well, the Tea Party, evil people, and so on and so forth. And yes, I do disagree with them on some issues. Absolutely, I do. And they disagree with me. And it doesn't make them right and me wrong, or me wrong and them right. It makes us Americans with different viewpoints. Of course, the immigration is one area is where we should all agree, because it does pose a threat to national security, because it does pose a clear and present threat to public safety and criminal justice and the economy and unemployment and health care and public health and education and the economy and the environment and even critical infrastructure. But the bottom line, as important as immigration is, we can all come together on that. That's what we really need to do. We need to work with all of our fellow citizens to come to the common sense understanding that if we have no control over who enters the United States, then there is no way on God's green earth that we can maintain a sovereign nation. Borders are the defining feature of countries, of states. Just about every border on this planet was drawn with the blood of those who had to engage in conflict in terms of international borders. It's rare borders are established without conflict. They are generally hotly contested. A country's first line of defense and its last line of defense are its borders. And the United States doesn't just have the four border states, you know, the usual nonsense we hear, California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. Any state with a seaport or an international airport is as much a border state as are those states to be found along America's northern or southern borders. But, of course, you would never know it if you listen to the nonsense being spewed by all too many talking heads on television, and certainly if you listen to all too many of our politicians. But something occurred to me while I was sitting on the airplane today flying home. And I thought, you know what's really incredible? We hear all this business about how terrible the Tea Party is. They're a bunch of bigots and louts and all this terrible stuff. I make no bones about the fact that from the day that I first cast my first ballot, 40-odd years ago, I have been a registered Democrat. I've since addressed the Tea Party Convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, not once but twice. In fact, the first time I addressed the Myrtle Beach Tea Party Convention, I was given an incredible honor. Think about this. The election season was in full swing. Senator Santorum spoke. Newt Gingrich spoke. And right as Newt Gingrich left the stage, they invited me up onto the stage for 25 minutes. I'm just going to leave you with a little thought. Mull this one over. Could you imagine a self-avowed Tea Partier being invited to a Democratic conference, meeting, rally, whatever? Not very likely. Not very likely. And I'm not bashing my fellow Democrats, individually, but in broad terms, with all this stuff that we hear, boy, those terrible Tea Partiers, I got to tell you, I spent a week in Minnesota, and I felt as though I was among not friends but family. They could not have treated me any more warmly. They could not have been any more respectful. And with one or two exceptions, even when we disagreed, it was done with respect. You could even say it was done with love. We understand that we have different perspectives and different priorities. That's the nature of the beast of politics. And in a manner of speaking, you could even say that we all possess a sort of prejudice. Now, before you get all excited and say, oh boy, we're going to talk about bigotry, we're not. What I mean by prejudice is that we are prejudiced about circumstances. We prejudge. That's what the word prejudice really means. If you've eaten seafood a couple of times and got sick, you're not going to be predisposed to eat seafood again. If you've done things that didn't work out well, you're reluctant to do them again. You know, the guy that goes hang gliding and breaks his collarbone is probably going to think not twice but 15 times before he, you know, tries that activity again. So we are all shaped by our life experiences. It's that kind of prejudging. You know, this is how I believe. This is how I feel. I learned this at school. I was taught this by my parents. I experienced whatever up close and in person in my own life. And people form opinions based on a whole host of issues. And obviously, we all have different life experiences. We come from different cultures, different heritages, different upbringings, different parts of the country. We're not all going to agree. That's why states' rights is a significant issue. Not that we're, you know, at each other's throat, but we're going to see things a bit differently. But immigration is the one area we could all agree on. You know, I stood in front of the room one day, and as we were riding off to this event, and Cindy was driving me, I said, you know what? You've heard a couple of my presentations. I'm going to shake it up a little bit tonight. And I did. I started out by asking the people that were sitting in the audience, do you think it's a good idea to keep people who are suffering dangerous communicable diseases out of the United States? Do you think it's a good idea to keep people out of the United States who are severely mentally ill, prone to violence, or are sex offenders? Do you think it's a good idea to keep people out of the United States, non-citizens, what we're talking about here, folks, aliens? Do you think it's a good idea to keep such folks out of the United States if they're convicted felons, war criminals, fugitives from justice, spies or terrorists, or people who would become a public charge, or people who would work on jobs that, if they did work on those jobs, would replace Americans, or at the very least, cause the wages for American workers similarly employed to be reduced and working conditions to worsen? And of course, they all said, of course. And I would like to know what political party that you need to belong to not believe that it's a good idea to keep out the people that I just described. In case you haven't figured it out, what I've just rattled off are the components of a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act, the body of law that's enforced, supposed to be enforced, forgive me, watching this administration. I don't think there's an immigration law that they like, except for the ones that allow to provide for citizenship and residency and so forth, and then they go five steps beyond. But in terms of enforcement, they are not keen on it. I mean, that's abundantly clear. Anytime a president and members of Congress can stand up and say, even if you ran the border, even if you evaded the inspections process that's supposed to keep out the sort of people that I just described, that, by the way, are contained in Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, just in case you want to look it up. If, for whatever purpose, you say, I want to make sure this guy Cutler's got it right, Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. Those are the categories of aliens who are to be excluded from the United States. They're not eligible for visas or entry. Who in the world could argue about it? Who thinks it's a good idea to let in terrorists or fugitives or spies or human rights violators or war criminals or people who are crazy and are likely to be violent, pick up a gun and shoot people, or people who are so deranged that they would go out and rape or perhaps assault children? So those laws are common sense. So I don't care where you stand on all the other issues. That's window dressing. That's the deck furniture on the Titanic, folks. If we can't get control of our borders, if we can't start to figure out who's here and make certain that we don't allow people to stay here or encourage them to remain here or reward them with potentially false identity documents because they're going to lie about their true identities to conceal themselves, which is the tactic of choice, by the way, of terrorists. Not my finding, but those were the findings of the 9/11 Commission to which I provided testimony. But to go back to these events where I spoke, think about it. I'm a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, self-proclaimed Democrat, speaking and welcomed in ways you can't imagine, the warmth that was just overflowing, to a bunch of events in Minnesota with a bunch of Tea Party people. To me, what I experienced this week, and I blame Cindy Pugh, state representative, it's all your fault, Cindy, joking, this is what America is supposed to be about. It's what the First Amendment is supposed to be about, that Americans from the four corners of this great nation can come together, whether we agree or disagree, whether we're of the same party or not, or the same religion or not, or the same race or not, and sit down and have a conversation to try to develop a better understanding of the issues so we the people can make better decisions when we vote, so we can sort through the nonsense and the fertilizer spewed by all too many of our alleged representatives. That's what this is about. And it was the most incredible week I have had anywhere in I don't know how many years. This was absolutely incredible. It was exhausting. You know, I kept telling Cindy that she needed to get a pair of rollerblades, and then I realized I was getting it wrong. I should have had the rollerblades. I just should have had her pulling me around. I mean, this woman does not stop. There was a radio show that I was on this morning, and what was so crazy about her show, about the show this morning, Cindy went to this place where they were broadcasting from. I think they were at a bistro or something, and she said to me with this, she has this incredible wide-eyed kind of an approach to life, "Oh, would you like to go with me?" And I'm thinking, oh, my God, no. I'm going to call this one in from my hotel room at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, we've been at it all week. I don't think this woman even sleeps. But it was an amazing experience. I was on the radio with Doc Thompson, and he is one of the people who broadcasts for the network called The Blaze. Great program. They were at the event that I spoke at yesterday. In fact, I wasn't even supposed to speak there yesterday. And Cindy the Dynamo came up with this idea and said, how about if we get you back up to the front of the room, because I had done my very first speaking event earlier in the week at the same place. And I thought, well, I'll just go up there for a couple of minutes. And the next thing I know, these two radio talk show hosts, Skip and Doc Thompson, had me come up and join them on stage for the bulk of the radio program that they recorded up there. And again, these guys are conservatives, they're Tea Partiers and so forth. They know my background, couldn't have been more accommodating. And after it was all over with, they said to me, tomorrow morning we want you back on the program at 6 a.m. I wasn't thrilled about it, but what are you going to do? And then, you go and do the program. So, but I did do it from the hotel room. But there's a couple of other, to use an expression I don't usually use, the kids use it, shout-outs or acknowledgments. I met a couple of chiefs of police, sheriffs and so forth. Again, could not have been any more accommodating. Chief of Police Eric Geisick of Burnsville, Minnesota. Great opportunity to sit with him and his officers talking about the problems that they face with crime, with gangs, that sort of thing. Lieutenant Bob Staup, he's the watch commander for the Hennepin Sheriff's Office. And we spent several hours together, gave me a ride along. We took a whole tour of his entire turf. Very interesting, the high crime areas. The one thing that struck me, I was asking him about money wire services because in New York it's a big issue. When you get to places like Minnesota, if you see three or four of those places, it's a big deal. In New York, just so those of you not from New York understand, you could drive down Roosevelt Avenue or other places, but Roosevelt Avenue is ground zero for the Mexican drug trade, and you can find a half dozen money wire services on every block for miles. So the scale of the problem of drugs and the money that leaves the country in New York compared with elsewhere is mind-boggling, and it gets me back to the point that I made earlier about what's really a border state. If New York was not a border state, explain why so much more drug money moves through New York and through Queens, in fact, here in New York City, than in most other communities around the country. We've got to get away from this nonsense about the Mexican border being the only threat that we're facing. So Bob, great guy, gave me a tour of the jail. There wasn't anything that he didn't show me. Whatever I asked to see, Mike, you got it. Let's go show it to you. Really amazing. They run an incredible jail system there, immaculate, spotless. Would that half the world's population lived in such a well-run facility. Very respectful of the rights of the people that are in custody. Almost look like a model kind of a situation, something that they should be proud of. Then I want to tell you, I met with Sheriff Jim Olson, another really great guy. We had a wonderful conversation about the issues that are of concern to him and his people. We spent quite a bit of time together. And then I want to mention in particular a gentleman by the name of Reed Ashpole, and he is the sheriff in Carver County. He's the commander of jail and administrative services of Carver County. His dad was a general during the Second World War. What amazing stories he had to tell. He actually, in his office, has telegrams that are up on the wall that were sent to his family when his father was taken hostage during the Korean War. Taken captive, not hostage, but taken captive. He was a war prisoner. Amazing guy. And he gave me a tour of the jail. And then he says, I have to show you something. What he showed me was a jail cell. And I'm looking around. And I said to him, okay, Reed, what am I looking at? He said, well, just stand here for a moment and soak it in a little bit. You know, just look at this. I said, I know that you're about to tell me something interesting. What is it? He said, this is the cell where they held Massawi, the supposed 20th hijacker who somehow never made it onto the airplane, the guy from France, the guy who was able to enter the United States under the visa waiver program. We all heard about Massawi in terms of the 9/11 attacks. It is believed that he had intended to be on one of those airplanes. Massawi was held in that jail in Minnesota, and this is my point, ladies and gentlemen. As I noted when I testified before a congressional hearing some time ago when John Hostetler chaired the Immigration Subcommittee in the House of Representatives, I made this point. No American city is safe if any American city is attacked. Think about it. Here we are in Minnesota. I didn't check the odometer, but it's about halfway across the country from New York, 1,200 miles, 1,400 miles, whatever the deal is. And one of the 9/11 would-be hijackers was in that jail. This issue of national security is an American issue. There is no way that anybody is going to convince me that immigration isn't anything but an American issue. I see that I've got a caller. Let's see if somebody wants to join the conversation. Let's see who we've got. You're on the line with Mike Cutler. Who's this?
Hi, Michael. This is Leon from Minnesota.
Leon, thank you so much for calling in. How are you? And I want to tell you, it was great meeting with you and all of your fellow Minnesotans. I hope you've been listening, and I hope you like what I have to say about your wonderful state and the wonderful people that I encountered and spent so much wonderful time with, real quality time, if you will, this past week.
Well, we're certainly hoping that you will come back and do it again. That was sure a pleasure to listen to you. You know, you didn't have a lot of time with us, but I think I could listen to you most of the day. I just want to comment.
Thank you so much for those kind words.
I wanted to comment a little bit about your what we were talking about, the Tea Party, and you addressed the convention or whatever.
Yep.
You know, I think we can be Americans without being attached to a political party, not.
Absolutely, and that is the point that I've been trying to get across. Don't you get this sense that there are politicians and businesses that are exploiting people and opportunities and so-called journalists that are engaging in a divide and conquer strategy against Americans?
I don't think there's any doubt, you know, and I think I shared with you when I emailed you a quote by George Washington. Do you remember reading that?
Well, I didn't see it. I haven't had a chance to get to my email yet, but I remember we sat in that wonderful restaurant, and you said, I'm going to send you a George Washington quote, and I'll be honest with you, I've yet to see it. I barely got home in time to go on the air this evening.
If you got a minute, I'll read it to you.
I would love for you to read it to me. Absolutely. Please do.
This is what he said. However, political parties, excuse me, may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. George Washington.
Well, and I agree. And, you know, the way I describe it is I don't believe that you can be a master to, or slave to two masters. How can you represent constituents when the leader of your political party tells you, I don't care what they want, this is what I want? Don't you think that goes on any day with a Y in it with those characters?
We see it every day.
Absolutely. That's why I say any day with a Y, which means any day. I mean, you know, and look, there's a guy that at each party they have someone known as the Whip. Does that not sound like a Tony Soprano mob enforcer, the Whip? We're going to whip you into shape and whip you into line, and boy, oh boy, if you don't stand on that line with us, we're going to cut off your campaign funds, and that is the mother's milk of politics, isn't it?
Well, you know, it takes money to buy votes.
Takes money to buy votes these days also.
Yes, yes.
Well, so, you know, and that's, but what I said from the bottom of my heart, I could not have felt more welcome, whether it was in that restaurant or the other places where I spoke this week, meeting with the police officials, meeting with the Republican officials. You know, when I chatted with these folks, I said, look, I'm registered as a Democrat because I'm a labor guy. My dad was a construction worker. I know we're going to disagree about stuff, but at the end of the day, we're Americans. And even a number of those Republicans who I met, some of whom were running for office, said we understand and respect that. So how in the world does the media twist things and say, well, the Tea Partiers are a bunch of bigots and a bunch of, you know, and if you remember, I don't remember if it was you or somebody asked, boy, you're thinking of running for president. This happened a few times while I was in Minnesota, and I thought it was pretty funny. I was very honored and flattered. Obviously, I'm not thinking of running for president. But the point of the matter is, could there be any more respect than that for you know, somebody from another part of the country, another political ideology? You know, think about it. It made me very proud to be an American when I could get together with fellow Americans 1,300 miles from home and be treated in such a magnificent manner.
Well, you know, when we were there and listening to you, and you came right out and you said that, you know, that you were from New York and you were a registered Democrat. But, you know, for me, and I think most of the other ones are listening to you, that was insignificant. We were
right.
Just blown away. We were just blown away by listening to a real American. It didn't matter.
That's right. And that's why I make that point, because I want people to lose the prejudice towards party affiliation. And nobody should ever vote a party line, by the way. I don't care if someone's from the Hopping Kangaroo Party. If they stand for what we believe in, then they are worthy of our support. And if they're part of a party that we thought we were aligned with, but they don't stand for what we believe in, they get two thumbs down. How's that for a thought?
Couldn't agree with you more, my friend. I'm going to cut you loose so you can talk to someone else probably, but we certainly appreciated your time in Minnesota, and come back and see us again.
Well, you know, it's funny, when I landed, I had texted Cindy that I was on the ground in New York, and I thanked her for everything, and she said, we can't wait to get you back, and I hope it happens real soon. I just hope that we don't have blizzards and avalanches or whatever. We had a sneak preview snowstorm, what was it, Wednesday night, but you do live in a really beautiful country, and I do hope to be joining you and your fellow Minnesotans real soon. So, Leon, I thank you so much for the call, and have a wonderful weekend, and say hi to everybody for me.
Thank you, Michael.
Be well. You know, and this is the point, folks. This is about being Americans before we are anything else. You know, united we stand, divided we fall. I am tired of having politicians. I am tired of having supposed journalists. All these other folks who are trying to divide us up. It's a very dangerous ploy. And I want to make another point, and I made this point when I spoke in Minnesota. I'm going to make the point again tonight. I've made it in the past, but it keeps on bearing repeating. This notion about the Latino voter is a myth. It's insulting to everybody. I am mortified when I hear it. And what's so remarkable is that you have journalists who would scream bloody murder at the mere hint that law enforcement might profile. And let's be very honest, there is justification for law enforcement to profile if it's situational, involves a whole bunch of other components. Not that you're stopping someone because they're black or white or green or purple, but where they are, how they appear, what they're doing, how they react, there's a whole slew. And I was an agent for 30 years. I worked closely with the cops. And this makes sense. It's proactive law enforcement. You stop somebody who's acting suspiciously, and the person's color may or may not come into play. The guy's ethnicity may or may not. Yeah, because there's so many factors that go into what you think he might be up to and so forth. And a cop who's doing his job or a federal agent who's doing his job should be alert to the totality of circumstances. But to simply say that because some guy's last name is Garcia or Rodriguez makes him likely to vote a certain way or behave a certain way or conduct himself or herself a certain way just by knowing the last name, or perhaps Goldstein, you know, all Jews, that kind of business. And I will tell you, as an American Jew, I resent it. I'm angered by it. I'm infuriated by it. I'm infuriated that we could look at anybody and say, oh, if that's their color, if that's their name, if that's their ethnicity, we know who they're going to vote for. It is a terrible form of profiling. It is bigotry at its absolute worst, and it does some real serious damage. And let me tell you what damage it does. If you ask the average person who knows nothing about immigration, really, just what they hear in snippets and pieces, because that's all you're going to get on TV these days, and you say to them, if you gave them multiple choice and you put three or four names up and said, of these names, who's most likely to be an illegal alien? If one of the names was a Hispanic name, they'd point to that name. And when they're out on the street, they're doing the same darn thing. And this bigotry is being perpetrated and spread by that nonsense about this mythical Latino vote. The president's looking for the Latino vote. Really? Do all Latinos think the same way? Do they all go to the same job? Do they all earn the same paycheck? Do they all drop out of school or go on to PhDs? Yeah. What is it that they all do? When you talk about the Latino vote, there's an Archie Bunker kind of phrase that comes to mind, and that terrible, disgusting phrase is you people. You know, you people, you Latinos, we know how you're going to vote. And I will tell you that I know quite a few folks who happen to be of Latino ancestry, Latino ethnicity. In fact, Tom Garcia, there's that name again, is the gentleman who made this radio program possible for me. He ran for Congress from Florida. He was a naval aviator and, in fact, a Top Gun instructor. He was an F-14 Tomcat driver, as they say, in the Navy, and he's now an American Airlines pilot, and his name is Garcia. And by the way, he's a registered Republican. How in the world do we hear this nonsense continually from one news source after another news source, and no one has the guts or the integrity or whatever to stand up and say to these folks, what the hell are you talking about? I am tired of the lies. I'm tired of the nonsense. I'm tired of the stereotyping. It doesn't work. The problem is we've become far too passive as Americans. We listen to this slanderous language, and people have lost the spine to stand up and say to somebody, shut up. Two simple words, shut up. We've had enough of your mouth. Folks, this is a bad situation. It damages people's reputations. It hurts the way people relate to one another. Instead of e pluribus unum, you know, out of many one, we are taking America, we are slicing and dicing it, and we're turning American against American. This can't end well. This cannot end well. We have to stop it. We really and truly have to stop it. And each and every one of us has a job to do. And, you know, this was another point that I made, and Cindy seemed to really like it because we were talking about it in the car, because some of these trips ran like an hour, hour and a half between destinations, so we had plenty of time to compare thoughts. And sharp gal, great conversations. I really had a great time. And she said, you know, this whole idea of we need a call to action, because I had said to her, you know, we really have to get people motivated. And she was so much in favor of it, she said, you really have to go out there and do that. And let me tell you what I said. If you go to a park and you see statues with people on horseback, they generally erect those statues to commemorate the actions of a singular person who at a moment in history did what was needed. Did what was needed. Maybe it cost them their life, maybe it didn't, but certainly they stepped forward and they took action. And sometimes it's not some humongous thing. It's not, you know, General Eisenhower leading D-Day, although no doubt, I mean, wow, one of my favorite presidents, Dwight Eisenhower. But, you know, it's about the person who has the guts to step forward and say, okay, you can count on me to do what is necessary. And then history remembers those people. History is recorded. And if you read history books, it's always about an individual who did something at a moment in time that was needed. You are needed, folks. You are needed. You are needed collectively to use your voices to beat back the lies, the foolishness, the anti-Americanism of those who think it's acceptable to undercut American workers and bring in cheap labor. People say to me, and I had this happen at the Tea Party, why in the world are you a Democrat and not a conservative? And my answer was, I'm a labor guy. My pop was a construction worker. He was a plumber. I saw what he went through. I listened to these darn politicians talking about the work Americans won't do. And I remember my father coming through the door covered in filth, freezing with icicles hanging off his hat. They didn't even have hard hats in those days. He died in the mid-1960s. He'd come home frozen, and that was in the winter. In the summertime, he would come home bathed in sweat, and he would sit in that bathtub, and the ring around that bathtub was black. Sometimes he would take two or three baths or showers to try to get all the grit and filth off of himself from the construction job. And I had made a deal with my dad. I said, you know, if you let me pick the color of the new car, he only bought one new car in his whole life. He worked at the World's Fair, made some overtime, so he bought a 1964 Chevy. And it's the only time he ever bought a new car, and I wasn't even driving yet, but I said I'd love to pick the colors, which was kind of dangerous because I'm colorblind. But we made a deal. I could pick the colors unless they were totally atrocious, but I had to agree to take care of the car and keep it clean. And when my father rolled into that driveway on Friday night, that car was covered top to bottom with mud. Unfortunately, the windows were covered with cigarette smoke residue, which contributed to his lung cancer. But the point was, that car was, you know, mud on wheels. And I would be out there for hours as long as the temperature was, you know, high enough that I wasn't worried about the water freezing. And I'd scrub that car, and I'd scrub the white sidewalls with Brillo soap pads, and I made the car look brand new so that the next Friday we could repeat the process all over again. And when I hear people talk about the work that Americans won't do, I want to punch their lights out. So I'm a Democrat because I believe in blue-collar America. I believe in working America. Would that our politicians believe that. We are bringing more foreign workers into the United States every month, folks, than the number of new jobs that are being created. What in the world kind of a strategy is that that makes any sense? And then we're seeing something really foolish now, and I want to get to this. I wrote a commentary, capsweb.org, and it got picked up by other websites also. And metaphorically speaking, you'll see how there's a little double entendre here. But I entitled my article, my commentary, How Do You Eat an Elephant? And, of course, the answer is one bite at a time. And you can draw whatever other analogy you might want to draw. But I was looking specifically at the immigration bill because suddenly you have members of Congress saying on the Republican side, well, you know what, we'll cut the immigration bill up. Forget comprehensive. We'll do it a piece at a time. Well, first of all, and I'm not going to claim to be an expert on the legislative process, but my concern is that once you start to talk about presenting any kind of a bill, my real worry is it winds up in conference committee with S-744, and then we get the whole elephant anyway. But here's the other part of the problem. The idea of providing millions of illegal aliens with identity documents, they don't need citizenship to be happy, especially terrorists. And that was the lesson that we should have learned from the 9/11 Commission. If you give people official identity documents that they can use as what we call a breeder document, it doesn't have to be citizenship. A green card works just fine. Political asylum works just fine. And I'm a big fan of political asylum. As a B'nai B'rith president, I've made this point on the air before. I went to demonstrations in Washington when Lyndon Johnson was president and I was in college, asking him, please, let the Jews and other religious minorities leave Russia, and, you know, we'll take a bunch here and let them go to whatever country would have them. I was thrilled to admit refugees into America. But today we know, and the 9/11 Commission made it abundantly clear, that political asylum has no integrity, so you have terrorists getting political asylum. Emil Canty shot up the CIA in 1993, January, and he had been an applicant for political asylum from Pakistan, and in point of fact, he was here to kill people. A month later, Ramzi Youssef, one of the attackers at the World Trade Center, they killed six. They injured over 1,000. They almost brought the towers down sideways. They inflicted $500 million in damages. And guess what? He had been granted political asylum. He entered the United States. They figured out that his documents were counterfeit. And being compassionate, they said, okay, you can have political asylum. And boy, did he find an interesting way to thank us, killing people. And almost killed God knows how many if the tower had come down sideways. So what could possibly go wrong with giving people identity documents and lawful status, whether or not it's citizenship? Now I want you to think about something else. Those doctor unemployment numbers are outrageous beyond words. 7.3%, 7.4%. Goodness gracious, nobody has a clue as to how many are really unemployed because of the games that they're playing with the numbers. And a while back, I wrote an article for CAPS, for Californians for Population Stabilization. This is on March 3rd of this year. And I quoted a guy by the name of Mort Zuckerman, the chairman and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report, certainly a serious news magazine. And he was talking about the current economic climate. And he said that the biggest difference between today's economic crisis and the Great Depression is that in the 1930s there were long lines of starving Americans waiting to be fed at soup kitchens while today's poor are invisible, staying at home and receiving Social Security, disability, and food stamps without leaving the house. So you don't have to go wait on that soup line. You don't have to go wait on that bread line. And let me read this quote, folks. I want you to understand really what we're talking about. And, you know, some people, and this became a part of a little bit of a debate I had with some folks during the week. Oh, all these people that are on disability, they're not disabled. Since Obama took office, those numbers have gone up, and Zuckerman addresses this. So I want you to pay close attention to how Mort Zuckerman described the growing American economic crisis. And by the way, his article is dated February 1st of this year, 2013. It was his editorial. And his editorials are long, but I guess when you're the editor-in-chief, he gets to decide how long the editorials are. Rank does have its privilege, I guess. All right, these are Zuckerman's words. Today, millions are assisted by checks from Social Security and by food stamps. Food stamp enrollment has been rising at the rate of 400,000 per month. More than 47 million Americans now depend on that program, an almost incredible record, for it is 15% of the population, compared with the 7.9% who received food stamps from 1970 to 2000. Meanwhile, nearly 11 million Americans are now collecting federal disability checks from Social Security, and half have signed on since President Obama came to office. In 1992, there was one person on disability for every 35 workers. Today, it is one for every 16. Such an increase simply cannot have been caused by direct disability experience during employment. This is, in effect, another unemployment program and one without end. Many of the people on disability would normally be considered unemployed. So look at this. How sustainable is that? More than double the number of people on disability. And many of these people are not young. So it's not like some guy says, I don't want to work. I'm just going to go on disability and ride for free. Do you have people like that? Absolutely. But when the numbers double that quickly, do you really think that's what's going on? I don't. Dan Rather did a story, Dan Rather Reports, and the title of it was No Thanks for Everything. He interviewed computer programmers who had lost their jobs because they were replaced by people from India. Amazing story. They were replaced by Indian computer programmers, lost their homes to foreclosure, in the case of one woman, lost her 401k and her life savings. She has an MBA in computer science, Phi Beta Kappa graduate, worked for Microsoft, for Gates, and came to work one day, and they said, here's your severance package. Have a nice day. Get out of here. And she hasn't been able to get a job in the computer industry since. This is crazy. You really need to see that film. Dan Rather did it about a year and a half ago, and I provided links to it in a couple of the pieces that I've written. This isn't about lazy Americans. It's about Americans who have given up hope, Americans who have surrendered their dream of the American dream. Why? Because the doors have been slammed in their face, slammed by this administration, slammed by the corporations who are buying the best government that money could possibly purchase, and it's destroying America. It's destroying the middle class. And then there's a story that came out, and it wasn't covered on the news. I watched the news. I spoke to some of my producer friends. Nobody wanted to run the story. And what was the story? Great story. Indian corporation pays a record $34 million fine to settle allegations of systemic visa fraud and abuse of immigration processes. Where did that headline come from that I just read to you? Well, guess what, folks? That was the headline on the ICE news release, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And I went ahead and let me just look for this while I'm doing this. I went and looked to see what they said in the news release. And I want to read this paragraph to you because this is really interesting. This is now the ICE news release that was put out there by Immigration and Customs Enforcement touting this great thing. And by the way, this fine is not insignificant. And I'm so angry with Infosys because a year earlier, one of their own employees, a gentleman from India, as I recall, a whistleblower came forward and said, this company discriminates against Americans, operating on our soil, practicing discrimination, and getting away with it. And getting away with it. Finally, they were brought in for a landing. But after how long? So here's what the immigration folks had to say. We will not tolerate actions that mislead the United States and circumvent lawful immigration processes, whether undertaken by a single individual or one of the largest corporations in the world, said U.S. Attorney Bales. He was the prosecuting attorney. The H-1B and B-1 visa programs are designed and intended to protect the American worker, and we will vigorously enforce the requirements of these programs. David M. Marwell, special agent in charge of Homeland Security Investigations in Dallas, concurred. This settlement against Infosys, I call it Infosys, it's a disease, is the largest immigration fine on record. The investigation indicated that Infosys manipulated the visa process and circumvented the requirements, limitations, and governmental oversight of the visa programs. The investigation also showed that more than 80% of Infosys's I-9 forms for 2010 and 2011 contain substantive violations. Ultimately, these actions by Infosys cost American jobs and simultaneously financially hurt companies that sought to follow the laws of this nation. Companies that misuse this visa process can expect to be scrutinized and held accountable. I agree. Okay, great. Now, look at what he said. Even if you're an individual, we're going to get you. There is absolutely nothing in the news release about any effort made to locate, identify, arrest, or deport the aliens who came in by committing visa fraud. So, rah-rah, we went after Infosys. They got hammered with this fine. But the illegal aliens they brought in, not a word about anybody looking for them. And let's face it, this administration's policy is to provide anybody who gets here with a green card or a pathway to citizenship, and so it goes. So it's great words, but my mom, may she rest in peace, used to say actions speak louder than words. Now, just to give you an idea about what was going on, because he's talking about H-1B and B-1 visas, an H-1B visa, for those of you not familiar, is a non-immigrant visa, meaning that it's for a limited period of time, enabling a foreign worker to come to America and draw a paycheck to do a job because he or she has an extraordinary ability that's not being met by American workers or lawful immigrant workers. So they're here to do that job because they can't find the proper people. The test is very, very small to do this. This whole system is gamed every day of the week. Lou Dobbs had a video where there was an attorney on stage with a bunch of other lawyers, and they were teaching other attorneys how to game the visa process so they could wind up getting their fees. And in fact, you hear this guy on stage making this outrageous statement that, well, this may sound funny to you, but your job is to make sure that an American doesn't get the job. Don't you just love it, folks? Your job is to make sure an American doesn't get the job. Comprehensive reform, by the way, would triple the number of H-1B visas and for the first time allow the spouse of an H-1B visa holder to get an employment authorization document. And what's so bizarre about that is that document does not limit the holder to a particular job. So, and it also would allow the kids, the adult children of H-1B visa holders to work in the country. So if you have a computer programmer that, let's say, goes to work for Ford Motor Company in Detroit, in Michigan, and he brings in three of his sons or four of his sons, and they're all auto mechanics, if they get that magic EAD card, which on a temporary basis gives you almost the same rights as a resident alien green card, they could compete on an equal footing with unemployed American auto mechanics. Even if there's thousands of unemployed Americans, they now would have the right to a job working as a mechanic, and they would have equal standing in the labor pool. This is insanity. We would triple the H-1B, and we would let all these family members work legally in any field that they want to work. The B-1 visa is a visa that does not allow people to work here for a paycheck. Apparently, what Infosys did, according to the allegations that, you know, they were fined for it, Infosys was bringing people in with B-1 visas, and a B-1 visa is a work visa, but very different. If you had a company in India and you were coming to America to buy computers for your company back home, you would probably come with a B-1 visa. Your paycheck is being drawn from back home, and you're here doing work, but the sort of work that doesn't have an impact on the labor market here in the United States, purchasing equipment or reviewing stuff, doing all sorts of things, but not taking a physical job inside the United States. That makes sense. So they you know, game that whole process, and now we're finding out, of course, that if we had comprehensive reform, guess what? We're going to triple those numbers, and we'll let lots more people from India come here. And, you know, we hear so much about Mexico. India gets more remittances from the first world, meaning the United States and Europe, than any other country. Last year, India was the recipient of $60 billion, with a B, $60 billion. Last year, $200 billion in remittances flowed from the United States to third world countries, including Mexico and India and China. And China, by the way, gets the second highest amount of remittances from the first world of any country on the planet, India being the first highest. And according to economists, when I went to school, they used to say that every dollar that gets pumped into the economy generates five more dollars. It's a 5-to-1 ratio. Today they say it's roughly a one to three ratio. So what that means is $200 billion has the functional equivalent of yanking about $600 billion out of our economy, almost two-thirds of a trillion. That's serious money. And then if you lay off Americans who had been taxpayers and they wind up on disability because they can't get a job, not only aren't they paying taxes, but they're using safety net programs to subsist. So their share of the American dream is out the window, and instead of contributing to the economy, they become a drain on the economy. How in the world does this make sense? And there are politicians out there saying, we're going to bring in the best and brightest because America needs them. Folks, the best and brightest are here. They're called Americans. And I can tell you that I spent quite a few of my years out on the street doing narcotics investigations, and there are a lot of very smart, motivated kids living in poverty, living in squalor, living in a violent environment. The question isn't what they would do to get out, it's what they wouldn't do. And if you keep on thwarting a person who wants desperately to escape from violence, poverty, and that sort of thing, and there is no legitimate way to do it, guess what they do? They turn to crime. So this lunacy that is going on in America, people are yelling about, oh, we got to control violence, we got to control the guns. How about getting the flow of narcotics cut down, and how about providing opportunities for American kids so they can be successful without becoming part of a gang, without becoming involved in criminal activity? If you keep thwarting people and their only choice is to stay in poverty and hear gunfire every night and duck for fear that a bullet may come flying through the window, those kids have nothing to lose by getting involved in crime because they're likely to get killed even if they don't get involved in crime living in those terrible neighborhoods. I've spent enough time in those neighborhoods. You want to reduce crime? Give American kids the opportunity, even if you subsidize their education, but make sure they have a job to go to when they get the degree. That's a child who's not going to become a criminal. What a novel thought that is. Could you imagine? I wrote a little thing here, and I said, you know, there's a little phrase perhaps that we could say, and that's illegal immigration is about mind over matter. The administration doesn't mind if you violate our borders and our laws, so it doesn't matter. And that's been the message for people from around the world. It's about mind over matter. The president doesn't mind. It doesn't matter. Think about that. And I want to read another quote to you. We're getting close to the end of the program this evening. I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Immigration Subcommittee, this past March 20th, 2013. And I said something that I hope resonates with all of you. The title of the hearing was Building an Immigration System Worthy of American Values. And I said, law enforcement is at its best when it creates a climate of deterrence to convince those who might be contemplating violating the law that such an effort is likely to be discovered and that if discovered, adverse consequences will result for the law violators. Current policies and statements by the administration, in my view, encourages aspiring illegal aliens from around the world to head for the United States. In effect, the starter's pistol has been fired, and for these folks, the finish line to this race is the border of the United States. This is where we are today, folks. We are in a mess because right now we have far too many politicians who think that the solution to getting reelected is to pander to a particular constituency. I can assure you it won't work. They don't apparently care that they are undermining national security. You have senators and members of Congress who have screamed bitterly about how Snowden could have been given a security clearance, how the Navy Yard shooter could have been given a security clearance. And then they go ahead and say, oh, it's perfectly okay to give millions of illegal aliens identity documents, even though there's no way of proving who they really are, no way of proving when they really got here. and no way of conducting field investigations to try to find out if they're lying on the application. And as soon as people come to understand that there's no interview, that there's no field investigation, you will embolden still more to commit fraud. I was an adjudications officer for about a year. I did the interviews like you see on TV. Sandra Bullock did a story about it a couple of years ago where she played the role of an editor at a book or a publishing company, ostensibly from Canada, and gets involved in a marriage fraud and all this other business. Well, it's a good movie. There was another movie with Gerard Depardieu, I believe the actor's name was, called Green Card. Well, I did that job for real. And what was so incredible was the grapevine, if you will, the fact that the folks out there in the immigrant community really paid attention. One of the things that I did, and we were all kind of left to our own devices to devise strategies to do a good interview to try to weed out the fraud, I came up with this idea of asking to see the keys that were in the pockets of the people who came in for the interview, because we would interview them separately. We would have the husband come in, the wife come in, we'd interview them, see if they knew when they got married and who the mother-in-law was and how much they're paying for rent, and I would ask all kinds of questions like that. Well, what I started doing was asking to see keys, and I would see if the keys matched. And you'd be amazed at what happened, because in short order, we had people coming in with shiny keys. They'd throw them down on the table before I even asked for them. As soon as I said, my name is Mike Cutler, and I'm an inspector, bango, they'd reach into the pocket, throw the keys on the table. I'd say, what are you doing? And the guy would say to me, well, we heard that if we went before you, you'd want to see keys. And that means some of the stories are pretty funny. In one case, the guy tossed the keys on the table, and I asked him how he came to the office that day, and he said he drove to the office. And I said, well, there's no car key here. Where did you park? He said, I parked across the street. I said, well, that's a parking lot. Could you show me your keys? Because in a parking lot, as you would imagine, you take the keys with you. You lock your car, and you go. He took out his car keys, and lo and behold, there were another set of house keys attached to the car keys. And I asked him who the house keys were, and he didn't know what to say, so he said, they're my girlfriend's. And the lawyer just put his head in his lap and said, oh, God, we're done. So understand my point. There is a grapevine out there. When I was a new agent, one of the old-timers had said to me, Mike, never forget, when a cop is chasing a bad guy, the cop is running for a paycheck. The bad guy's running for his life. And if you don't think that people on the street are paying attention to what is happening or not happening at immigration, you're crazy. And as soon as the word is out that there's no interview, all bets are off. In fact, when I first started doing those marriage interviews, it was the first, because up until then, there were no interviews. So you had people coming in and saying, yeah, we live at 123 Main Street, and if you ask them about it, the guy would say that they lived on the top floor of a six-story building and there was an elevator. And the woman would say, we live in a basement apartment. They didn't even realize there was going to be an interview, so they didn't even know what to say. And as soon as the word was out that there's going to be an interview, that there's going to be questions, they started to study the questions. They started to even try to figure out which adjudicator was going to ask what question. The Obama administration has made it abundantly clear. No interviews, you get identity documents, no field investigation. Basically, fraud, I assure you, is running rampantly through the program. This is a threat to national security, not because Mike Cutler said so, but because the 9/11 Commission said so. You need to understand that what is happening today at immigration, at Citizenship and Immigration Services, flies in the face, goes 180 degrees in the opposite direction from the advice and findings of the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony. This, folks, is unacceptable. We've been attacked a number of times. Some of those attacks were thwarted because of good police work or good law enforcement and intelligence work by my former colleagues. Some because of dumb luck, and I always like to say that if hope is not a strategy, then dumb luck is not a success. And in some cases, there have been tragedies. Think of the Boston Marathon bombing, if I can get the words out. It just happened April 15th. Two guys who I would question the authenticity of their political asylum application from Russia blew up the marathon. This is a serious threat. We are destroying national security. We are destroying the middle class. We're making the American dream more and more just that, a dream, not something that you could ever expect will actually happen, all because of an agenda that is in play because of politicians who either lack the courage or the integrity to do what is vital for America and Americans, the people that they were elected to represent, and the constitution of which country they were elected to uphold and protect as well. So these are issues that I want all of you to give thought to. And you really also need to give thought to the idea that Americans who disagree with you politically are still Americans. They're no less American than you. They are no more American than you. And we all need to work together, even if we disagree on other issues, to make certain that where the immigration issue is concerned, we all stand together, because this is about national security. This is existential. It's about the survival of America, folks. It's about the future of our country, the future of our children and their children. And we got to do it. You know, I always like to make a point at the end of my commentaries, but before I do, I'm just going to put the websites out one more time. Please go to capsweb.org, michaelcutler.net. I thank my friends in Indiana. Cindy, if you're listening, Mara, Debbie, thank you so much for being terrific tour guides. I can't wait to be back there with you. Go to the websites. Check out what the Tea Party is doing in Minnesota. They're great people. They truly are. It was a pleasure to be with them. And I want all of you to remember, folks, that democracy is not a spectator sport. Next week at this time, I will not be doing my program. I have a reunion to go to with a bunch of old farts like myself, the guys I had the privilege of serving with for 30 years. But I will be back a week from next Friday. So check in, and I hope you'll be joining me then. But meanwhile, have a great weekend, everybody. Good night.